and this is the Esther Life Show. Each week, I'm meeting people from the worlds of cancer, cancer research, and cancer treatment, looking to find out what's working and why. This week, I'm talking to a scientist from MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Stephanie Seneff. Stephanie is a senior research scientist in computer science and artificial intelligence. Her interests have been in the intersection of biology and computation. More recently, she's turned her attention towards biology and the relationship between nutrition and health, and has published openly critical and controversial papers on the effects of glyphosate in human health. I first heard Stephanie speak at a Weston Price Foundation event, and I was interested to hear more of her original thinking regarding cancer that she shared at that event. So, hi Stephanie, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. And I'm delighted you've agreed to take part in the show to share some of your scientific expertise with the listeners on some important subjects. I hope you'll forgive me if I interrupt you occasionally to go over some any more complex material, as you've got important things to share, and I really want to try and ensure we get the most from them.
And yes,
yes, I know that some of the work you do is quite complex. So there's two aspects of your work that I'm very interested to talk to you about today: your theory of the development and the role of cancer in the body, and also your recent work on glyphosate. So starting with your theory. I heard this a little while back when you came visiting the UK, and it it certainly stretched me to follow you through it, but I found it very interesting. That's what's made me really want to talk to you about it. To me, it contained a radically different message to the traditional view of cancer. I mean, cancer's talked about like an alien invader that wants to take over your body, but if I understood you correctly, you're suggesting that it's a process which is initiated to deal with another serious problem, and that it's actually doing a great job keeping you alive for longer, a kind of emergency measure. So would you like to explain a bit?
It's really a very novel point of view, and I'm actually surprised that others haven't thought of it either, because I believe that biological systems are very well tuned to be able to adjust to a different crisis situations by having different strategies for coping with them. And it makes a lot of sense to me that if when the body's really, really stressed, and the situation is that the blood is so severely impaired that it's hardly working at all, once the pathways that are delivering goods and removing garbage are busted, the whole system is in trouble. And so it's actually very beautiful to think that some set of cells will, in a sense, decide to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the larger good. And what they do then is sort of turn into embryonic-like cells. They start multiplying to make a larger mass, and they take on the activity of removing toxic molecules from the blood and producing products that are going to help fix the blood. So both getting rid of bad things and adding good things to the blood to fix the blood so that it can circulate and provide fuel and clear garbage.
Very interesting. So it's like there's an alarm call. Things have got to a very serious state with the state of your circulation and your blood, and so this process is actually doing a job of stabilizing things in a certain way.
Right. Well, making the blood so it can work again, so that everybody will be happy. Otherwise, organs will start failing.
Interesting. So, the reason that this struck a chord with me is that, it hasn't escaped my attention that, one of the most amazing things about the human body is that day in, day out, however badly I treat it, it's always doing its best to stay well. And it does that whether I like it or not. I can help it or I can hinder it, but I can't stop it from trying to keep me well. And so cancer, in a way, the way it's normally portrayed, is a complete anomaly in that picture. Now, you're saying that actually, no, it makes sense in with everything else to do with the body.
Right, and this notion of cancer cells turning on you, people use that term, that they've turned on you, and it's not true at all. They're actually sacrificing themselves because they're living a very harsh life. They're living in an extremely toxic environment because they're putting up with a lack of oxygen supply because they have a very poor blood supply. They're putting up with an oxidative environment. They've got all this inflammation, which is going to damage them. And they're able to change their metabolism so that they're much better able to cope with methylglyoxal, which is a really potent glycating agent, and they actually are able to metabolize it, and they're better able to deal with it as a toxic chemical than other cells are because they've changed the way their metabolism works to protect themselves from it, okay, so that they can dispose of it.
So what? Just give me the name again of that substance,
methylglyoxal, methylglyoxal, methylglyoxal. It's an actual, it's much worse than glucose. So, you know, you think of diabetes and you have too much sugar in your blood.
Yes.
And it, and then sugar is a glycating agent. It'll damage the hemoglobin and other blood proteins. Fructose is 10 times as bad as glucose at that same thing. So fructose is even worse. And methylglyoxal is, I believe, 10 times again as bad as fructose. So 100 times as bad as glucose in terms of causing this damage.
Okay, where's it coming from? Why have you got this excess?
That's an excellent question. And it's coming from the sugar. It's a breakdown product of these sugars. It's actually a smaller sugar. The smaller the sugars are, the more toxic they become. So the glucose and the fructose didn't get properly metabolized. They should have gotten turned into carbon dioxide and oxygen and water, but instead they didn't get the process didn't get completed, and they ended up being converted to methylglyoxal. Now, I've actually worked out a theory. This is getting into the glyphosate issue, but glyphosate messes up the body, the gut microbes' ability to process fructose correctly, and as a consequence, fructose piles up in the liver and causes damage there, causes fatty liver. But it also gets converted into methylglyoxal through pathways that become more prominent because of glyphosate's presence. So glyphosate can make fructose be much more toxic than it would otherwise be, creating a bunch of methylglyoxal that needs to be disposed of. And cancer cells can help to get rid of that methylglyoxal.
How interesting. Okay, well, you're right. You've pulled in the second subject there.
it's hard to stay away from that.
You've been well involved with that. So many things seem to come back to the gut these days. I talk to lots of people about chronic disease, and so much seems to be, it seems to be such a basic to health, the gut. It seems to be the central part of our immune system, as far as I can tell.
Right. Oh, the gut is so important. And of course, it's nice that people are finally realizing that. Researchers are really writing lots of papers these days about the gut, and they're learning how to analyze all the different gut microbial species and their genomes and their products and trying to figure out what's going on there. Because people have really woken up to the fact that the gut is such an important part of our physiology. And those gut microbes are really like another organ. In our body, and they have so many roles to play that when they're not working well, we're not healthy. And of course, glyphosate is a patented antimicrobial agent, and it messes up particularly the beneficial bacteria. It destroys the lactobacillus, and the lactobacillus are so important really at the beginning of life. That's the microbe that eats milk, you know. So when you're drinking lactose milk, lactobacillus thrives, and they grow and they take over the space so that they choke out the pathogens. But if the lactobacillus isn't healthy, then that allows the pathogens to grow. And that's how you get the inflammatory gut, because your immune system comes in and tries to kill the pathogens.
Yeah, very interesting. So, I mean, we're pretty cavalier about our gut, really, with the things that go down there these days, aren't we? Because, quite apart from glyphosate, I mean, the number of things that are in industrialized food, antibiotics that are used, again, in a very cavalier manner, probably far too often, certainly in this country. I know they're very overprescribed. And all these things are actually disrupting your gut flora, aren't they?
Yes, there's many things. In fact, I've been reading about carrageenan. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Carrageenan is another...
Sounds right, yeah.
Something that they put, they have all these different really chemicals that they put into the food. When you look at a soy protein bar and you look at the list of ingredients, it looks like a whole bunch of chemicals. It doesn't look like food, you know?
Right.
And they take the foods and break them down into sort of molecules, in a sense, to pure products. Instead of being a food, it's just like an ingredient, like high fructose corn syrup, you know? It's no longer... Even if you take like organic dark brown sugar, that's not just pure glucose. That's all kinds of different ingredients in there. But when you have these chemicals that they produce through the processed food industry, and then they mix them back together again to make these pseudo foods, I think that's a huge part. I mean, I don't know to what extent that's the problem versus the poisoning with the glyphosate. Both of them are problematic.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that industrialized food has two inherent problems. One of them is that, yes, it is laden with things which are not food. And in order to deal effectively with those, what you need is good nutrition. And that's the other thing about it, is that the nutritional content is very low as well. So you're right. Saddled with a problem that you've got to deal with a lot of toxins without much resource.
Exactly. That's what happens. So you get depleted in nutrients that you need to be able to detox the poisons that you're being exposed to. Mm. And it's a double hit.
It is. Yeah. Okay, there's another aspect of this which I find interesting. It's definitely in a slightly different territory to the one we've been talking about. But, you know, if your theory turns out to be the case, one of the places this can have quite a big effect is on our psychological and emotional relationship to cancer. You know, we've been taught to fear cancer as our arch enemy ever since Nixon there. You know, set off to do battle with it. And we've used the vocabulary of war to describe treatment. And right. The treatments themselves have indeed espoused the similar kind of shock and awe tactics in the way that they lay waste to the human body. And we're supposed to, you know, bring it on, doc, give me the worst thing you've got, you know. And
right, it's an idea as you kill the cancer cells a little harder than you kill the main cells, but you're killing everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of my earlier guests on the show, a lady called Sophie Savage, has just published a book, which is doing incredibly well, entitled The Cancer Whisperer, outlining her choices to make peace with her illness. And so far it's working very well for her. She's surviving well beyond the odds already with she had a terrible cancer. You know, I think there's quite a few people speaking out for their distaste for this whole sort of war metaphor. And, you know, it is actually part of us, cancer. It's not an alien invader, is it? It's
Right. And, that's the way I look at it. And I didn't finish my story about what it does for you, because it does get rid of the methylglyoxal, but it also produces sulfated sterols. It's very interesting that breast cancer cells produce estrone sulfate and prostate cancer cells produce cholesterol sulfate, which is a molecule that is very dear to my heart. I've really studied cholesterol sulfate, and I believe it's a very, very important molecule for the blood, you know, and for making the blood healthy. And then colon cancer cells actually produce hydrogen sulfide gas, which is very interesting because that can be oxidized to sulfate, either by the gut microbes or by your own cells. So all of those cancers are producing a product that's going to help resupply sulfate to the blood. And I think the sulfate deficiency is a key issue in multiple modern diseases.
Interesting. I don't hear other people talking about that. So that's very interesting. Okay. So, yeah, it is a completely new take, if you like, on cancer. And it's an interesting one because you're giving us a scientific model, if you like, of how cancer is working to our advantage, even though we might not think so. And of course, say people emotionally are finding that it just doesn't work for them, this whole sort of battling with themselves, you know, model.
Right. And in fact, the chemicals that they use to treat the cancers actually cause cancer. So you're increasing your risk to other cancers when you're treating the cancer that you have. And furthermore, you can shrink the cancer down to a small size, but when you do that, in a sense, it gets mad and it becomes more likely to metastasize. So it sort of it recognizes that it's in a toxic situation, it can't survive, so it sends off colonies to other parts of your body. So you start to get cancer metastasis in your bone or in your brain. You know, that of course is much, much worse than your original situation of having a cancer in one of your other organs. Like a breast cancer, you know, the breast is vestigial after your menopause. So it's not an organ that actually needs to do something else. True, it can just sit there and be a cancer and provide you with this rescue for your blood. It's interesting, too, that when they do surgery on breast cancer, there's an increased risk to thrombosis following breast cancer surgery than there is, cancer surgery in general compared to other surgeries. Thrombosis, of course, is a crisis in the blood, and I think it's because you've taken away the tumor that used to be helping the blood to survive, and now the blood can no longer rely on that tumor, and that's why you end up with a thrombosis.
Would you sort of hypothesize that if you set out to put the situation right, that the one that was wrong, that the cancer was responding to, if you rebalanced your blood properly without doing anything to the tumor, that the tumor itself would recede because it was no longer needed?
I believe that. And in fact, if I, luckily I've never been diagnosed with cancer and hopefully I never will, but if I were, that's how I would treat it. I would start really working on doing even better in terms of eating organic food, eating lots of sulfur containing foods, getting lots of sunlight exposure, because I believe the sunlight is needed to make the cholesterol sulfate. Basically doing everything I could to fix my blood to help the tumor in its job so that the tumor is no longer needed. And in fact, I've talked to someone, unfortunately I can't remember his name, but who treats cancer, and he's talked about, and he treats it homeopathically, where you provide, you help the cancer to live instead of killing it. You do the exact opposite. And he said the cancer actually grows. It gets bigger. And you think, oh my God, this isn't working. And you get really nervous. And then it gets bigger, and then it collapses and disappears. Once it's done its job, it's just, okay, I'm all done now, I can close shop.
So very interesting. I mean, of course, a lot of the things that you described, people who are taking, you know, an integrative approach, they will do all those things quite often. And so, you know, they may not be thinking about it quite in the way that you are, but maybe a lot of these successes that are being had are down to the mechanism that you've just described, which is you've actually taken away the need for the cancer.
Exactly. You nurture it. You nurture it back to health to the point where it no longer needs to do this job anymore and it can close shop.
Very different view. Okay. Well, fascinating. All right. So maybe we'll move over now to the area you've been researching a lot recently, from what I can gather, glyphosate.
Yes.
So firstly, the basics. What is it? Where is it? Why should we be concerned about it?
Okay, glyphosate is the active ingredient in the pervasive herbicide Roundup and many other products as well that have glyphosate formulations. And Roundup is one that is very common in the U.S. People buy it at the hardware store, use it to kill weeds in their yard.
Right.
It's supposed to be extremely non-toxic to humans. It's supposed to be a wonderful herbicide for that reason. What happened in about the mid-1990s is they came up with this idea of engineering the core crops so that they were resistant to glyphosate. Glyphosate kills all plants, and if something that kills all plants, you need to worry about that, because that's pretty toxic. You know, it's got a general mechanism that is not discriminating and just kills every single plant, including a lot of microbes, as I said. It's an antimicrobial agent as well. And so it would be surprising that it could do so well at killing the plants and the microbes and not actually do harm to us. That would be a very surprising
result. It would be really surprising, yes.
Yes.
Doesn't make sense, does it?
It doesn't. And so they figured out, they sort of said, oh, this is a non-toxic herbicide. It's so fantastic. We don't want to be using the ones like 2,4-D and dicamba that are more toxic. We'll engineer these plants so that if we spray glyphosate on them, they don't die. They basically provide the plants with a special bacterial gene that allows them to sort of get around the glyphosate toxicity, and they're able to survive. So you go in the airplane and spray the glyphosate all over the crop. It won't die. The weeds all die, so it's very nice. You don't have to. You have no longer have to worry about your weeds. In theory, of course, it never quite works that way. In fact, so that was the idea. Of course, what happened was that not too long after they started growing these Roundup Ready crops, they started to get Roundup Ready weeds. So weeds that
resistant
were also resistant.
Weeds.
Yes, essentially Roundup Ready weeds. And they've gotten more and more problems every year with these resistant weeds, which is causing them to have to use more and more glyphosate. So they claimed they'd be using less with these GMO crops, but in fact they're using more, and it's a lot more. I mean, it's a ridiculous, I don't know, 800-fold increase over the past 20 years, something like that. I mean, it's an enormous increase in the amount of glyphosate being used on the crops every year. And no one's paying attention to how much is getting into the food because the government thinks it's non-toxic. So it's a very dangerous situation. There was just a new article that came out a few days ago about a study on cotton. And I've been wondering about cotton because cotton is GMO Roundup Ready. And, of course, it's in your clothes, you know, it's in your toilet paper. It's like all over the place, right?
Yes.
And they measured cotton in cotton swabs and cotton gauze, various things that are used in the hospital, cotton balls. Tampons, you know, all these common cotton products, and they found 85% of the tested samples contained glyphosate. So I found that really surprising.
So
I mean, shocking, really.
Yeah, no,
Maybe
absolutely.
Not surprising, but
But
you confirms my suspicions.
Yeah, well, I suppose it does make sense. But of course, you know, these days there's so many places we have to look out for, you know, things that are apparently completely innocuous have actually got something in them. But now, thanks to somebody's smart idea on how to make them their shelf life better or something, and yeah, that's right. So organic cotton is now beginning to be as important as organic food, probably.
Right, I'm starting to think we should go shop in thrift shops and make sure the clothes we buy are 20 years old.
Yeah, right. Okay, so anyway, as you say, they ramped up the amount of this glyphosate being used because, of course, nature always has its way of resisting attacks, and right. The weeds are getting tougher and tougher and more able to deal with the stuff. This is a very important element, actually, is that glyphosate. Yeah, it gets used on its own and everybody goes around and squirts things in the garden with it and everything. But the big news with glyphosate is that it's teaming it up with the GMOs, isn't it?
Right.
This thing of being able to make crops that will withstand it. And, well, of course, there's an awful lot said about GMOs on their own without the glyphosate as to how actually good for humans they are. Do you have any opinion on that yourself?
Right. I mean, it's interesting because I certainly have friends who really believe the GMOs are very, very harmful in and of themselves. And mm-hmm. I'm not saying they're not. I think they probably are. And I think the story is much, for me, it's harder to make that argument. We don't know the science well enough. With glyphosate, once you look at what glyphosate does and you look at what that effect of that would be in biological systems, you can see all kinds of horrible things that would happen. You can just predict them just based on the molecule and what it can do. Whereas the GMOs are harder to figure out just because we don't know the science. If, in fact, you can always say, well, it could be possible that so-and-so could happen, and if so, that would be terrible. And the question then is whether it does happen. Things like the siRNA not getting broken down in the gut and therefore starting to... Because these things, these control elements that they're messing with.
What is siRNA? What's that?
So this is the latest thing they're doing, and that's different from the earlier ones. The earlier ones are inserting a bacterial gene that makes a product, like a protein. But now they're starting to do what I think is even scarier, which is this si. It's called, the I is interference. I'm not sure what the S is. But siRNA. Mm. It's a kind of RNA, which is like DNA.
Yes.
You know, DNA, RNA, it's nucleotides. But this RNA is a control element. So it actually turns on and turns off various genes, which means it can change the amount of protein, the different proteins that are made in a cell. It can really change the way a cell behaves as a controlling element. Hmm. So it's very high level messing around with what's going on in that cell. Now the claim is, and they can actually just spray the siRNA on the crop, which I find really shocking. And apparently it doesn't break down very easily when it's sprayed on the crop, which makes me think it wouldn't break down very easily in your body either.
Right.
So if it goes through the gut and doesn't get broken down and gets into your own cells and this stuff is universal. I mean, it's not like it's only a control for plants. It actually controls other species as well. So it's going to go into your cells and do God knows what in terms of controlling, telling them to turn this on, turn that off, you know, change their whole gene profile,
right,
which sounds really scary. So this
is...
can imagine really frightening things, but I don't think the science there is as conclusive as it is with the glyphosate, in my opinion. The glyphosate's more straightforward because it's just a chemical that's causing chemical reactions.
Mm. So you say this is actually in commercial use now, these siRNA?
I think so. I think it is. I think they're rolling it out, and I think they think it's wonderful. They're doing the same kinds of arguments of what could go wrong. I mean, they're very naive. You know, in my business, I'm a computer scientist, and you check your code pretty carefully, you know, and things are run through all kinds of tests. It feels like that biotech is much, much scarier in terms of the damage it could do than a piece of computer code.
Mm.
And yet they're extremely sloppy in their tests. They just kind of seem to have the attitude that, a naive attitude, that nothing could go wrong when they don't even understand how it works, which I just find shocking, you know?
Right. Well, you know, in terms of the businesses behind it, I would say it was a willful naivety because, I mean, obviously they're out to make money. That's what a business is for. And the people who really shouldn't be naive are the people who are regulating the whole area. And, one wonders who's influencing them because they seem to be an enormous enthusiasm for things which are, as you say, have got massive potential for harm on an unthinkable scale.
Right, exactly. It's just incredible that the regulators are willing to just buy the argument that the companies make that everything's harmless and everything's wonderful and we're going to feed the world, you know, the whole message that it's going to feed the world and there's no downside. It's just incredible to me.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. Anyway, it's obviously the amount that story is brought into is pretty variable by country. America is super enthusiastic about it. We're less so here in the UK, and some countries have actually, you know, banned it outright, and that's that. It's getting a bit of a run for its money, you know, in terms of, you know, it's not a complete pushover, but it's certainly made massive inroads in terms of, if you just look at the acreage that's down to these kind of techniques now, it's shocking.
Right, especially, of course, in the Americas, both North America and South America seem to be very enchanted with this technology. And it's scary, too, that we have these, that are the kinds of crops we're growing are becoming more and more restricted, that we just have these massive amounts of soybeans and massive amounts of corn and canola and sugar beets, you know, to just supply those foods for the processed food industry. And those things are all GMO engineered, and they're all loaded with glyphosate. So the processed food is going to be loaded with glyphosate, and we're just chronically poisoning ourselves.
And there's two kind of basic rules, which I think, you know, they're well established and everybody knows. One of them is that when you kick out against things in nature, they kick back, you know, and you end up just having to kick harder and harder. And the other one is the dangers of sort of kind of monocultures, where you have, you know, just a few species or whatever it is that you're using, and you know, and something goes wrong, you know, like a new kind of bug or whatever it is, and you know, the whole of your food supply is suddenly threatened because you haven't got diversity.
Right, and it's even within that one crop that you've only got one strain. You know, you've got that GMO Roundup Ready soy. And, for example, the cotton in India right now is being attacked by something, I think a white fly. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about that?
No.
The GMO Roundup Ready cotton is facing a massive problem with this new white fly, which apparently the non-GMO cotton does much better against it than the GMO one does, which is not surprising.
Yeah, well, it's heartening that, you know, in a few places in the world, I know that some people are going to great lengths to preserve old species of things because they were disappearing so fast. But I think, you know, these things could be lifesavers in the end.
I know. It's going to be, it's just sad that we're losing the heirloom seeds. It seems like there's an active effort to get rid of all the heritage seeds and things like that. Glyphosate, and I'm working on a paper with, actually I have a paper that's about to appear with Anthony Samsel on glyphosate and cancer.
Okay.
And so we've researched that pretty extensively and really found a lot of evidence.
Okay, but do you want to summarize what you found?
Yeah, it's sort of, so I was just thinking, I brought that up and it's hard to summarize because there's so much, but I do think glyphosate, first of all, there's cancers that are going up dramatically in step with the dramatic rise in the use of glyphosate. For example, thyroid cancer and pancreatic cancer have a very good match. In the United States, we have an epidemic, you know, a great increase in both of those kinds of cancer in step with glyphosate usage. The pancreas in particular is quite interesting because glyphosate definitely attacks the pancreas, and I think that's connected to diabetes as well. Diabetes is also going up in step with glyphosate usage on corn and soy crops. And the pancreas is really stressed by the glyphosate. And, of course, this causes a number of problems, in part with digestion, because the pancreas releases digestive juices. So that makes it harder for you to digest if it's not working properly. Yes. And that's how you can get issues with proteins such as casein and gluten. You know, the people who are resistant, who are allergic to wheat and allergic to milk products, there's so many more people today.
Yes, I mean,
that are facing these.
Yes, that's interesting, that one. It's like it's quite difficult to distinguish between are there more and more people who are resistant to these things, or is it the more and more people know they are? It seems it's quite a hard one to tease out that.
It's interesting. I didn't know that people were saying that, because it seems very clear to me that more and more people are, that people
right,
are getting
okay, good.
More and more sensitive, especially in the United States. You may not notice it as much there, because I think we have a much worse problem here. Wheat in particular is not GMO Roundup Ready. But I discovered that it was that it sprayed with glyphosate right before the harvest. And that's a practice that's becoming more and more popular, to actually poison the plant. So the plant is not able to resist glyphosate. But the idea is that you kill the plant right before the harvest intentionally.
Wow.
And then you grab the seed just as it dies. And so there's bound to be glyphosate in that seed.
And they're not bothered because it's so safe.
Right, exactly. And they're using that for sugarcane as well. So that makes sugarcane bad. And of course, beet sugar is GMO Roundup ready. And high fructose corn syrup comes from corn, a GMO Roundup Ready corn. And so all of those sugars are going to be toxic because of the glyphosate. And we've had a lot of chatter recently about, oh, sugar's bad for you. You know, all of a sudden they're saying, oh, sugar's bad.
It suddenly arrived, isn't it? Yes.
And I think it's because it's poison. The sugar has glyphosate in it that's poisoning you.
Right. So you think, I mean, it's bad in its own right anyway, but with a special serving of glyphosate as well, I'm sure it's a lot worse. Okay. So anything else, particularly findings from your paper?
Yeah. Well, the cancer. It's just, well, first of all, Anthony Samslow was able to obtain a bunch of documents from the EPA. It took him a while to get them to release those documents, but these were Monsanto's own studies back in the 1970s and 1980s that supposedly showed that glyphosate is harmless to humans. And in their own studies, they found statistically significant appearances of cancers in animal studies. And they managed to pull in what they call historical controls. When they compared against their own control rats or mice, they found significant increases in cancer, but they were able to find some mice from previous experiments decades before that were probably exposed to something like DDT, who knows what, who also got lots of cancers, and they were considered to be controls. So they were able to pull those in and substitute them for their own controls in order to say, oh, this is not really statistically significant after all.
Wow.
They swapped controls into something.
What a sleight of hand, eh?
It is very big. And the other thing was they noticed that glyphosate was more toxic at very small levels than at higher levels. So they had done different, you know, low, mid, high dose, and the low dose had more cancer than the mid dose. And they said, well, that's ridiculous. That can't be true. So therefore, this must be garbage. You know, you don't need to believe this because it's backwards.
Yeah,
and it turns out, of course, that these estrogenic agents like glyphosate is, things that have hormone disrupting agents have that kind of behavior,
right,
that at very low doses they're more toxic than they are at higher doses. Very counterintuitive.
So
they decided after that, they buried these studies, put them into a secret bin so that nobody could look at them, and then they decided never again to do studies at those low doses.
Right. So this has happened before where a company has been exposed later on that they actually did know what they were doing and they were poisoning us, and it's now been actually labeled as a potential carcinogen, hasn't it?
It is. I'm so glad about that, WHO. Yeah. They really took through.
So they sort of lining themselves up for some massive suit from people who got cancer who are going to say it's from exposure.
I hope what's going to happen.
I mean,
just like the cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very parallel situation. I mean, the actual human consequences of covering up that kind of data knowingly are unthinkable, aren't they?
They are, and I don't understand how anybody in their right mind could do that.
Mm.
To take that risk, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so this program's all about cancer, but I believe you're also very concerned about the relationship between glyphosate and autism as well. And I'd be interested just to hear a little bit about that. Yeah,
I definitely think that the epidemic in autism in this country is due mainly to glyphosate. I think it's working synergistically with other toxic chemicals, but I think it's the main contributor. The correlations are stunning. If you look at autism in first grade, over time against glyphosate usage on corn and soy crops over the previous 4 years, you get two curves that coincide. You get a perfect match in those time trends.
Okay.
And then you look at all the things glyphosate does and all the things autism is, and those things also all line up.
Explain those a bit, because that's the tricky bit. Well, how in particular does this chemical end up creating behaviors in children like this?
Right. Well, for example, manganese deficiency is a key one. And manganese deficiency causes a lot of the problems you see in autism, such as mitochondrial dysfunction. The mitochondria are the source of energy And when the neurons can't get energy, clearly they're going to be in big trouble. And mitochondrial disorder is linked to autism. And the mitochondria have to have manganese to keep, to protect themselves from damage. And glyphosate prevents them from getting manganese. Glutamate also is a neurotoxin. Glutamate is a neurotoxin in the brain. And it is detoxed by converting it to glutamine using an enzyme that depends on manganese. And manganese also is needed for the pituitary gland to release hormones that stimulate the thyroid to produce its hormones. So if the pituitary can't produce those stimulating hormones, you get hypothyroidism, which is linked to autism. If a mother has hypothyroidism, she has a fourfold increased chance of producing an autistic child. Mm. So all of those are just linked to the manganese alone.
Wow, just one substance, yeah.
And it's been shown in the autism as well that they have high levels of glutamate in their blood, low levels of glutamine, which you would expect. They have low manganese in their teeth, their urine, and their hair. So that one goes a long ways, but it's not just the manganese. There's a whole issue with the sulfate, and glyphosate disrupts sulfate transport, sulfate synthesis, and it causes sulfate loss through the kidneys. Autistic kids have a low availability of sulfate, and in particular in the cerebral spinal fluid, it's been shown through brain studies post-mortem, it's been shown that the autistic kids had low levels of sulfate in their cerebral spinal fluid, and they had a mouse model that was impaired in its ability to produce these sulfated molecules that are essential for the function of the producing new neurons out of precursor cells in the cerebrospinal fluid. So it's really fascinating that these mice that were engineered to have this defect produced a version of mouse autism, all the different features of mouse autism these mice had by virtue of not having that sulfate.
So this sulfate is crucial to the process of the nervous system then, basically. That's what
it is.
Yeah.
It's crucial for producing new neurons from precursor cells. So that's the whole growing of the brain, the maturation of the brain. It's also essential in the synapse. I mean, sulfate is really, really important. It's essential for the energy production of the cell, so many things. Also for clearing the garbage, and that's a part that links also to Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's has this buildup of amyloid beta plaque, which is, I think, because the cells are unable to break down garbage and recycle it and repurpose it into useful new proteins. And so they can't break down garbage because they don't have enough sulfate. Mm. So it's also a problem in Alzheimer's, sulfate deficiency in the brain.
So these, you're saying these things have been noted, these deficiencies and these excesses of various things, and those, as you say, they can be seen to be a consequence of glyphosate. Has it been tested actually correcting these things? I mean, is it possible to correct them if you have a situation? Obviously, you want to stop getting any more glyphosate, but there's a certain element to it which is a permanent imbalance. Is that right? After you've started?
Yeah, no, I think actually, I actually have heard of case anecdotal evidence of children having their autism reversed.
By doing what?
Going on an organic diet, getting high sulfur, glutathione, and taking nutrients that will help them to beef up their sulfate supply. Mm. And, of course, it's also glutathione that's depleted. That's known to be depleted in autism as well. And methionine is a precursor to glutathione, and methionine is one of the amino acids that's reduced in the context of glyphosate. So glyphosate is interfering with the supply of sulfur sources to the body. And getting more sulfur, getting sunlight exposure, eating an organic diet, eating fermented foods so you can help to beef up your gut microbes, maybe even taking probiotics. Mm-hmm. So various nutrients, making sure your minerals are good. So drinking a lot of bone broth, to get your minerals back up, because glyphosate really messes up the minerals. So you can basically, I think you can reverse autism if they're young enough, if it's early enough, you can reverse it through this process of the organic diet, the sunlight, the sulfur containing, also eating a lot of cholesterol. So eating a lot of eggs, organic eggs and seafood, scallops and clams and oysters and things like that are going to be very helpful. And then getting sunlight. Sunlight is going to help you make the sulfate.
Right. Well, I think you've done a good job on the next thing I was going to ask you, actually. I was going to ask you to summarize your advice to families who are concerned about their health in this way. You've said a lot there. Is there anything you want to add to that? It's just general advice to people who are beginning to become aware that this is an issue. What sort of things should they be doing?
Yes, so of course I said that, and I'll say it maybe again, but eating foods that are high in sulfur, and that's not just the animal-based foods. You have the eggs and the seafood, but you can also eat sulfur-containing vegetables like garlic. Garlic is really good.
Right.
And onions. And also eating lots of herbs. Herbs have polyphenols, which can help you transport sulfate. So you're always thinking in terms of how to beef up the sulfate. I also recommend Epsom salt baths. Epsom salts are magnesium sulfate. If you live near sulfur hot springs, that's
the best, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the best.
Yeah.
And I encourage that as a way to get sulfate. So it's you need to beef up your sulfate supply to make your blood healthy. And once your blood is healthy, then all your organs will also be healthy.
And a few of the things you pointed to as being particularly beneficial, like bone broth, of course, a vegetarian's not going to be too interested in that. Is it possible to get a similar benefit from something that's not an animal product?
Right. I worry about vegetarians, actually. I'm not good at recommending how to be a vegetarian.
Right.
Certainly eating lots of spices and lots of herbs. Spices and herbs, I think, could compensate for the lack of cholesterol in your diet. You're missing animal fat and animal cholesterol, which are really important. The sulfur, animal proteins have more of the sulfur-containing amino acids, so they become short as well. There's a cobalamin issue, B12 issue, if you're strict vegan. That's hard to fix. Maybe take cobalamin supplements if that's okay with you to do that.
Yeah.
If you're vegan, because cobalamin can be a serious problem, and we have an epidemic in cobalamin deficiency in this country.
So on your scale of things, a vegetarian would be a lot better off than a vegan because they're going to get eggs and dairy.
Eggs
and
will solve the problem, actually. I think you could be a vegetarian with eggs and you'd be all right. But if once you eliminate the eggs, it's much harder to get, I think, the nutrition that you need. But it's not impossible. I mean, there are so many vegetarians in India for so many years that have been able to do okay on it, right? And I think their trick is the spices, like the curcumin is fantastic. Curcumin transports sulfate.
Right.
And it has special properties that allows you to produce sulfate because it energizes, it mobilizes electrons. It's very fascinating. In response to sunlight, even. I mean, sunlight's playing a role there, too.
There's almost nobody who doesn't come up with a good word for curcumin.
It's amazing. It's really, people have said that it's really kept the Alzheimer's rates down in India. And they eat a lot of spices, and those are wonderful spices. I really like the Indian food. If I were going to be vegetarian, I would be eating the Indian style.
Okay, so just to look at the biggest picture now, I mean, we've gone a long way down the road with GMOs, with glyphosate. If the situation is anything like as serious as you're pointing to, say we just even look at autism on its own, we're looking at a very sharp rise, I think, in the number of autistic children.
It's very scary. I mean, if you just project the curve exactly as it is right now, you're going to have 1 in 2 of the kids born in 2032 on the spectrum, 80% of the boys.
80% of the world. I mean, how on earth can any economy sustain
impossible.
That? And just autism. We're not talking about cancer, of course, which is going in a similar direction.
Exactly. And of course, there's all kinds of other problems that children are having: ADHD and asthma and eczema and gut problems.
Do you see these things as all interconnected, as all being different symptoms of a similar problem?
I think they're all connected to glyphosate.
That's interesting. So
we really think that if we could just ban glyphosate and take it off the earth, that we would see such dramatic improvements.
So laying a lot at the door of this one chemical that's being used.
Yeah. Now I know there's a whole bunch of other chemicals that might be coming right behind. The reason why I say glyphosate is not necessarily because it is so much more toxic than the other ones. I think the other herbicides are probably equally bad. But it's the one that's been going up dramatically.
Right, it's the one that's the most.
It's the one that's hugely used. So you've basically, if you take away glyphosate and replace it with dicamba or 2,4-D, you're not fixing anything. You just have another set.
Right.
I don't know what, but other kinds of problems. Probably a lot of overlap. We have to get rid of the herbicides. I think the herbicides have to go, all of them.
Right, and how do you see that happening? I mean, of course. there's not great signs in America, for instance, of it turning around yet, are there?
No, well, the only good news we have, and I feel it can work grassroots, I don't have any faith in the U.S. government. They are so in bed with the industry. Mm-hmm. I just don't think they're ever going to bend. And so it has to be up to the individual. And I think as more and more people, you know, listen to shows like this and get the word and then decide, I'm going to go organic. I'm just going to go organic. And even to start growing their own organic garden in their backyard to take ownership over their
right.
food.
Right.
And if people start doing that sort of victory gardens, you know, mm-hmm. It will help us, first of all, to have food, because if we suddenly just took away glyphosate, there'd be a scramble to kind of convert all those giant farms into something else, right?
Yeah.
And the soil has been ruined as well by the glyphosate. Every year the soil gets worse, and it's going to be a crisis. It's a crisis looming there, because we're going to have, as you said, crop failures. When the soil gets depleted in all the nutrients, then the plants become susceptible to fungus and things like that. So we're going to have issues with all kinds of diseases among the plants. And you know, when you have this monocrop, the whole thing could just blow up. It could just disappear.
It could be horrendous, couldn't it? It could be mass
yeah.
starvation, basically.
Right. And so I almost am hoping something like that happens, for example, to the corn crop, just to wake us up. You know, we need something really big. I would think autism is big enough, but the government seems to think that they can just blame it on better reporting, which I think is completely not true.
Right. Mm. Okay. And the efforts towards labeling that have gone backwards and forwards, you know, the big battle being waged there, seems to me useful if we can actually get them to write on products that contain GMOs, so that people do actually have choice about what they buy. Maybe they can't afford to go and buy organic all the time, but they could pick the one that doesn't have the GMOs in it.
Right. I think that would be helpful. And of course, the industry recognizes that, which is why they're fighting so hard. It's just amazing how much money they spend working on defeating these bills. And of course, the government, U.S. government is trying to implement a law that will prevent the states from doing it at all. So that'll just annihilate any efforts on the part of the states, which is really disturbing.
It is. Okay, well, look, I think that's about all we've got time for today. It's been a real pleasure and honour to have you on the show, and I really appreciate your willingness as a scientist to ask those hard questions and to speak out about what you find in the interest of public health. So, thank you very much indeed for that, and thank you so much for all your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, and we certainly covered a lot of territory.
We did.
Yes.
Well, you can probably appreciate that Stephanie has received a fair bit of hostility for her open criticism of industrial science. But I do think it's critical that these subjects are aired and that we all have the opportunity to decide for ourselves where to draw the lines on safety. Industrial science has been seen to consistently ignore the precautionary principle in the interest of profit. And sadly, we don't seem to be able to put our faith in regulatory bodies to provide us with the protection that we need. If you've anything you'd like to say about this or any other Yes to Life show, please do email radio@yestolife.org.uk. That's radio@yestolife.org.uk. Links to material relevant to today's show are on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk and click the link to the Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar, and then to UK Health Radio. Next week, I shall be speaking to the well-known author and nutritionist, Patrick Colford. So I do hope you'll be able to join me again. Goodbye.